finished up Ephesians, I'm going to bring you a message this morning from the Old Testament. I don't know whether I'll start a series on the Old Testament or not, but in the next few weeks, I want to share with you something that is that's been on my heart, and I hope and pray that it will impact you, and that it may impact others. And I'll share more about that with you next week. But this dovetails right into it. You remember when, as kids, when you were, going on a vacation when you were young, and you go on vacation, and you go a long way away, say, 8-10 hours, even longer. They across the country. I remember when I was 8 years old, and we went across the country to visit my aunt and uncle in California, from southern Illinois to California. Long way, only 8 years old. What was the refrain that us kids, when we go on a long vacation and we're going on a long trip? Are we there yet? When are we going to get there? And usually by that time, you know, your mom's about ready to pull her hair out because as when you have several siblings and you're sitting in the car and one's on one side, what do? You fight over which side you're on. You know, that's my side. That's not your side. Mom, she's looking at my side. Remember things like that? Because you're going on a long trip and that's what the, and then you get over with that, and they get you to play in a game, and then what comes back? Are we there yet? When are we going to get there? We're all concerned about that. If we stop and think about it, though, that's an important question. That's an important question about one's life. Whatever your destination will be, will you be where you want to be? Maybe a better question, though, is this. Will you be where you should be? At the end of your destination, as far as one's life goes, will you be where you should be? I think that's a more important question. Many people should ask, well, where do I want to go? What do I want to do with my life? And maybe an important question for us at the church, here Crown Hill is. What do we want for the church at Crown Hill? What do we want for ourselves? What do we want the destination to be? I sincerely believe that there's no other quality, or I should say, no other factor in one's life and in the church that determines the quality of one's life and the quality of the church than the answer to those questions. You know, people often talk about, and you hear this a lot, especially because of all the self-help and self-analysis books and everything, you often hear talk about, you got to discover who you are. The church needs to discover who it is. Now, you may not have heard things like that, but believe me, when I go to like the conference at Boise and that, I hear those things. The church needs a vision. The church needs a goal. The church needs a mission statement. It's okay. Okay. Then many develop the church and develop their lives along those lines. But where do they get it from? Where should they get it from? See, that's the important thing. It's where should they get it from? Again, we can read all the self-help books, self-analysis books, church growth books and everything and get answers there. And they say for each individual and for each group in each church, it should be different. It can't be the same. Or it's not yours. Okay. There are such people out there on the, if you want to find him on the internet, on TV or what have you. You ever heard of the John Bradshaw? Leo Buscaglia? Those guys have been around for a while. Deepak Chopra? You turn on the telly and get on the internet, you can and see those guys. And those what they promote. But I like what the and agree with the late Richard John Newhouse, who stated this: the shoddy material peddled by Bradshaw and others is not simply unchristian, and many Christians do listen to those people, those things, but as he said, it is not simply unchristian, it is anti-Christian. And he said, put differently, it is spiritualized and psychological atheism. Because they talk about, and we hear this even in church circle. You have an inner child trapped within you, and you must get it out. You must discover what that inner child is in order for you to be free. Or they talk about the wounded child. Many of us are wounded. Many of us have been wounded throughout life. In things that we experience and stuff in growing up. That many people are discontented with life. I'm going to talk more about that in the weeks, in a few weeks as the weeks go ahead. But the truth is, we do not discover who we are as much as we decide who we are. The church doesn't discover who it is as much as it decides who it is and what it's for. And that's us. And that decision is made in how we go about answering certain questions, which again, as I said, in the next few weeks, we're going to explore that a little bit more in depth. You know, I love reading and studying the Word. I love reading and studying the Scriptures. And that also includes the Old Testament. Many people say, well, you should just stick to the New Testament. Say, the Old. But there's many lessons in the Old Testament that we can learn from. So it's important for us to understand that. And I want us, for a few moments today, to look at one of the most positive individuals that we can learn from and find in the Old Testament. And all that in the nation of Israel. They knew who that is. We don't talk about him much. Oh, we hear about Joshua fit the battle of Jericho, you know, and the walls came down and that. And Joshua led the children of Israel. And he did. He's Moses' successor. God set him apart for that. So we hear a lot about Joshua. And hear a lot about the others, about Moses and everything that they did. Gideon, and his fleece, and so forth. But one individual that we don't talk about much, and you don't hear much about, Caleb. Joshua and Caleb together. There's two incidents outlined in Scripture concerning him. The first you find in Numbers chapter 13. Remember that? The children of Israel. They spent 40 years. Well, they spent a number of time, not the 40 years yet, but they spent a number of time, years, getting to the promised land. Numbers 13 tells us they're at the promised land. What does Moses do? Remember the song, the children's song we grew up with and we teach our kids? What did Moses do? He sent out 12 to scout out the land, didn't he? Did you know when you read the scriptures there, the 10 guys, we don't know who they are. It doesn't say who they are, does it? Numbers 13 doesn't relate who the 10 are. Now, when you read out there, Moses sends them out, and the leaders of the 12 tribes, men set out for the 12 tribes, doesn't tell us, says that 10 came back. And they said what? See, what they were to do, to scout out the land and say, can we take the promised land? Can we go? And we all know the story. They come back, and 10, and they ask him, well, what's it like? And what did the 10 say? Oh, no way. Why, now, they could have been exaggerating. Perhaps, indeed, they were. No way. Why, we're like grasshoppers to those people. In essence, what the 10 were saying, we'd be eaten alive. No way could we do that. You read that in Numbers 13. Oh, it does name out those who they sent out. And Moses sends them out. Tells us, indeed it does tell us who, I was wrong, it does indeed tell us who they were. So he sends them out, but they come back. And as we read what they said, and notice here, it does flow with milk and honey, and here's the fruit. But those people in that land, like he said, they said, we're like grasshoppers to them. They're strong. Their cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we know the descendants of Anak, the Anakim, are there. Why, we can't do that. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and the Hittites and Jebusites and Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of Jordan. Why, no way. Now, who were they forgetting in all of that? But now notice, they stand at the threshold of the promised land. Who was it that quieted the people? Joshua and Caleb went. Who was it that quieted the people? Caleb. Caleb quieted the people, because you can imagine the 10 were saying, oh, we can't do that. And all, we're talking about over 1 million people now, the children of Israel. You can imagine them all murmuring, saying, we can't do it. There's no way we can do it. And Caleb quieted the people. Before Moses and said, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they're too strong for us. So what happened? Who'd the people listen to? They listened to the 10, didn't they? That's what we teach our kids. Isn't that song? 10 were bad, 2 were good. So they didn't do it. And what happened? God said, all right. Just remember who they were leaving out. God said, all right. Just for that, all the people in your generation, except for Caleb and Joshua, will die in this wilderness. You're going to wander around this wilderness. 40 years. They didn't have, can you imagine that? Just wandering around the same area all that time? But remember when God told them to do that? Then what did they say? Now, we'll listen. All right, God. We don't want to do that. We don't want to wander around the wilderness. We're going. And they go to take it, don't they? And what happens? They are overcome, aren't they? Why? Because God said, I already told you. I already gave you my judgment. You're going to wander around this. You said you can't take it, so you're not going to have it. You people that are alive now, except for Caleb and Joshua, you will not take it. And they try to, and they're repulsed because God is not with them. God was on their side. Caleb and Joshua. He was on the Israelites' side too, but they weren't on his side. They forgot about him. So now we turn to Joshua chapter 14. The second incident found in our text. 45 years had gone by since that incident. How old were Caleb and Joshua when they went out to spy out the land? These weren't teenagers. These weren't boys that they sent out, that Moses sent out. They were 40 years old. Men. Mature men, supposedly. And 10 said, no, we can't do that. So 40 years had gone by. Now it's 45 years had gone by. The Hebrews, God's people, had finally entered the promised land. How old is Caleb now? Caleb is now 85 years old. Not a young man. He's 85 years old. And this is what he says to Joshua. God promised that Hebron belonged to me, and now I want that hill country. I want that land. He's now 85 years old. They have been in the promised land for 5 years. This is a very exciting story, I do believe. Look at what Caleb says. The sons of Judah drew near, and Joshua and Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, said to him, you know the word which the Lord spoke to Moses, the man of God, concerning you and me in Kadesh Barnea. I was 40 years old when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. And I brought word back to him as in my heart. Nevertheless, my brethren who went up with me made the heart of the people melt with fear. But I followed the Lord, my God, fully. So Moses swore on that day, saying, surely the land on which your foot has trodden will be an inheritance to you and to your children forever, because you have followed the Lord my God fully. Now behold, the Lord has let me live just as he spoke these 45 years. From the time that the Lord spoke this word to Moses when Israel walked in the wilderness. And now behold, I am 85 years old today. I am still as strong today as I was in the day Moses sent me. As my strength was then, so my strength is now. For war and for going out and coming in. Now then, he tells Joshua. Joshua is the leader of the children of Israel now. They're both the same age. But he tells Joshua, now then, give me this hill country about which the Lord spoke on that day. For you heard on that day that Anakim were there with great fortified cities. Perhaps the Lord will be with me, and I will drive them out as the Lord has spoken. So Joshua blessed him and gave Hebron to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, for an inheritance. Therefore, Hebron became his inheritance. First thing that teaches us, Caleb. Only two instances you hear about him. Numbers 13, where he's sent out, and this one. But it tells us that he took that hill country. But the first lesson that we learn there is that Caleb was in line with God's purpose. That has to, brothers and sisters, has to be first and foremost. As far as our lives and as far as the church is concerned. Moses made the promise to Caleb. 45 years went by. In all that time, Caleb did not forget about that promise. See, Caleb would have helped the children of Israel conquer the land, and now he's 85 years old. Now he says, it's my turn. Notice that Caleb does not say, Joshua, give me a lot of people. Give me an army so I can take that land. Mm-mm. Caleb says, Moses said I could have that, that's my inheritance. And he tells Joshua, now give it to me. Let me have that as my inheritance. And 85 years old, Caleb says, I want it. I want that hill country. It's mine. And Caleb says, I'm as strong as I was 45 years ago. What was Caleb saying? Caleb was saying, I can take it. It's mine. God promised it to me. I can take it. It is mine. You see, Caleb's desire was to claim what God had already promised him. But he didn't have it yet. He was in line with God's purpose. Now, brothers and sisters, you know as well as I do that we live in a society which is obsessed with success. Still is. Has been for many years. Many say that it's just something that's built into us, into our makeup. It's part of our human evolution. That's what they like to say. Because I don't believe that. But we need a clear understanding of how success is to be measured. You see, what is success? We learn from Caleb here. What is success? When you look at society, success is measured in four different ways. Sometimes success is measured by internal opinion. We have an idea of what we want to be or what we want to do. And if we establish that idea or image in our mind, we set about to do it, and we fulfill it, and we do it, hey, I'm a success. I've succeeded. Now, if we don't, we feel we have what? We feel we fail.
We don't blame God for that.
What's that?
We don't blame God for that.
Well, I mean, yeah. Sometimes success is measured by external opinion, though. In that case, our success or failure is measured by what? By the judgment of others. If they consider we're a success, we are. Or vice versa. If they think we're a failure, we're what? We're a failure. And we become a failure in our own eyes. And pleasing our peers or pleasing our friends then becomes the purpose. Sometimes success is measured by external standards, though. Society set many of those. For instance, a high school diploma. I mean, people think that's a standard of success. Or if you don't get your high school diploma, GED, that's your standard of success. Well, you name any field. You get a certain position, you obtain a certain degree, pass a certain test, attain a certain certification, say like you do it at Boeing or what have you, you attain a certain certification, I made it. I'm a success. However, as Christians, and what people need to learn, success is really, truly measured by an eternal standard. God standard. I firmly believe that success is not determined by our feelings. It's not determined by the opinion of others. It's not even determined by so-called fixed standards in society. Ultimate success is determined by God. And it is measured by our faithfulness. Caleb, brothers and sisters, 45 years! And he said, I want that hill country. And Caleb said, with God, I can take it. Caleb knew how success was measured. That it's in line with God's purposes. That it's in line with him. He knew he wasn't doing it on his own. I firmly believe this. If you please God, it doesn't matter who you displease. If you displease God, guess what? If you displease God, it doesn't matter who you please. His approval is the key. That's why I preached in the Sermon on the Mount what Jesus said when the translations say, happy are those in the Beatitudes. No. The word there is blessed. But what does that word mean? It means you have his approval. Because you're in line with his purpose. God's stamp of approval upon our lives. That's the measure of success. That's the measure of faithfulness. Caleb, brothers and sisters, understood that. And he was faithful to God and faithful to the children of Israel 45 years. And when he was 85, at 45 years, then he goes to Joshua. Joshua, my turn. I want that hill country. It's mine. It was promised to me. But Caleb understood that he wasn't doing it on his own. He was doing it with God. He was doing it with the Lord. Think of this. 85 years old. Most people, by the time they get that age, if they do get that age, what are they? Even before they get that age now. See, I have a lot of friends ask me, well, Gregory, when are you going to retire? That friend tell me that. Family said, when are you going to retire? You want to tell them? I'm not. What? Well, you know, when you get 65, you should be retired. No. I have no plans on it. But most people, by the time they get a certain age, they believe, now it's time for me to sit back. I'm going to sit back and relax. Have all my kids take care of everything. And I'll just sit back and I'll relax. Settle in. Verse 14 there. What does it say? Therefore, Hebron became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh the Kenizzite, until this day, because he followed the Lord of God of Israel fully. He didn't give up. He didn't just lay back. What's the point here for us? The point is that we are never too old. You ever read some of the list of the people who made great accomplishments in life? Late in life? Alfred Lord Tennyson wrote his greatest poem, one of my favorites, Crossing the Bar. How old he was when he wrote that? 83. Michelangelo, the great sculptor, the great artist, when he completed his masterpiece of all masterpieces, his greatest work of art, you know how old he was? That's a painting in the Sistine Chapel, by the way. You know how old he was? 87. Imagine that, being on your back. And that's what he was, a scaffolding. You ever seen the Sistine Chapel? Pictures of it, how high that thing is? He was on scaffolding. 87 years old when he finished. Took him years to finish it, but he was 87 years old. He's laying on his back there like that, painting. Can you imagine that? It's hard for us to think and fathom things like that. Winston Churchill, 4 volumes he wrote on the history of the English-speaking people. Great books. You know how old he was when he finished it? He wasn't a young man when he wrote those. He finished it at 82. Benjamin Franklin, you know how old he was? He was the one that brought the compromise, that brought the great document of the U.S. Constitution that many people don't know about, don't know today and should. You know how old he was? 81 years old. None of these guys, brothers and sisters, were young. They were not young people. So what does that teach us about ourselves? What does that teach us about the church here? It is this. We are never too old, but also never too young. I firmly believe that there is for each of us a land of Hebron, brothers and sisters, metaphorically speaking, that God has set before us, and his desire is that we claim it. God has that for the church here. And his desire is that we claim it. And just as it took Caleb, the third thing we learn is that it's going to take effort. Look at what Caleb says in verse 11 there. He said, I'm still as strong today as I was 40 years ago. He knew. He says the Anakim were there in that hill country. He knew he would have to struggle and fight. He knew it would take work in order for him to get that hill country. And the same thing with the church. And for us as individuals, it's not going to be easy. Caleb had to struggle and he had to fight. He had to conquer those people. But you know what? We have to conquer things in our own lives and in the church as well. What kind of things do we have to conquer, you think? Well, you think about Caleb. I believe he had to conquer adversity. We have to as well in our own lives and in the church. Someone's always going to be opposing us. There will be those who will strive to stand in our way. I've experienced that. I've had friends tell me, what are you doing here? I said, I'm doing the Lord's work. Well, you don't have many people? Yeah. And I come right back at him with this. Because they're going to criticize us. They're going to try to discourage us. And we have to be aware of that. And try not to be discouraged. Whose church is this? Is it man's church? Is it the individual church? It's his. I had an elder, he was an elder in a church years ago, and they eventually did that. This elder said, if we have people come in, but they don't do what we say, they don't do it how we want it done, well, we'll just shut the doors. You know what? Years after I left, I learned a number of years ago, that's what they did. They shut the doors. The church no longer there. You know what they forgot? Whose church it is. It's his church. It's the Lord's church. You want to call them giants or what have you, setbacks we can say is the word failure, setbacks along the way. But the key, brothers and sisters, is moving beyond them to eventual victory. And I believe that eventual victory is there. A setback is saying that, oh, we're just a failure. But that's looking at it from the world's eyes. Not from his eyes. As long as we're in line with his purpose, we're not failures. We're success. We're successful. And who's our ever-present help in trouble? Isn't it God? God will help us. That's what Caleb said. He wasn't all alone. Sure, he had others to help him take that land. But overall, he had God. Who controls our lives? See? The key is found in verse 12. The Lord helping me. So often we forget that. We want to do it all in our own power, both with our individual lives and with the church. But we have to realize it's the Lord helping us. The scriptures are replete with those who couldn't do it on their own and with those who made excuses. Remember Moses? What did he do? He's 80 years old too. Do you know that? When God called him to take the people out of Egypt, he's 80 years old. He could have told God, said, God, I'm 80 years old. I'm an old man. I'm not going to do that. Find somebody else. He did use excuses, didn't he? Oh, I can't speak. I'm tongue-tied. God says, all right, Moses, your brother's on his way to you. He'll be your spokesman. Any more excuses now? And Moses gave it to him, but yet God overcame those, didn't he? God will overcome our excuses if we let him. Gideon, we're talking about Gideon? Gideon starts out with all these thousands of guys, and God said, nope, 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 nope. Okay, now you take a number of guys down there, and let's see who drinks the water and laps it like a dog. And those who just reach down and put their hand up so that they can observe what's going on around him. What does God do? God picks those people. But yet, you can imagine that here Gideon is. He says, okay, God, now I believe. Well, I got just this many people. Now how am I going to take him? Where's my swords? You know, where's my weapons? And God says, got trumpets? Yep, got trumpets. Okay, take the trumpets. You got some empty jars? Yep. God said, take those empty jars. Can you imagine getting and saying, what? We're going to defeat the Midianites with those? Guess what? They did, didn't they? David, Goliath. David said, I don't come on my own. I come in the name of the God of Israel. And he will defeat you. And he did. Why did the early disciples turn the world upside down? Did they do it on their own? They didn't, did they? Did they? Because God was with them. And they realized that, brothers and sisters, and they turned the world upside down. The gospel. As I said last week, when Jesus is hanging on the cross, they mock him and say, let him save himself now. He saved others. Let him save himself. Little did they realize, he didn't need to save himself. He was saving them. Why? Whenever they said that, that's when Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. See, God will help. We must not forget that. God is in the midst of us, brothers and sisters. We want to build the church. We want people to come to him, to the church. Must be in line with his purpose. We must not forget him. He is above it all. One of my favorite songs, which we're going to use as closing, I heard this many years ago. Some of you may have heard it, some of you may have not, but there's a lesson within this song that I want you to listen to. One of my favorite songs is it's not by him, but it was Wayne Watson's first song that gave him his record deal, The Touch of the Master's Hand. If you've never heard that, just listen to these words. Beautiful song, and there's a message in there for us.